Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 374 for Wednesday, April 11th, 2018. That familiar music was composed in 1896 in Germany by Richard Strauss. The director, Stanley Kubrick, picked it up for his film 2001, A Space Odyssey, and the piece has been forever associated with that. Although Elvis used it to open his concerts in the 1970s in Vegas, and Deodata got all funky with it in 1973. But it's most associated with 2001, and that's what we're here to talk about today, because this month marks the 50th anniversary of Kubrick's science fiction epic, the biggest box office hit of 1968, a film variously described as hypnotic, opaque, a milestone of cinema. It remains one of the most popular films in public opinion surveys, and it's also known for being remarkably puzzling for a lot of people. Popular, yet puzzling, with an ape throwing a bone, a black monolith, and the final image, at the end of the 2.5-hour film, a fetus. Say what? Here to talk about 2001, A Space Odyssey, are our film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. Linda, Chris, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Dan.
Excellent to be here.
Excellent, because this is an excellent film. I love to talk about this, and I want to see the film again. The anniversary makes me want to see it again. I haven't seen it in several years, but I thought it was remarkable. Did you like the film the first time you saw it, Linda?
It changed my life, and I'm really I'm not overplaying that. I've thought about it a lot through the years. It was the film that made me realize that cinema was the most important art form. And, you know, I was quite young when I saw it. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even mention this except that it's an experience that is echoed in so many accounts of first experiences of seeing the film, particularly for people who are under the age of like 15 or even 10. This sense of wonder, the magnificence of it, the sensation of being in a world that is all engulfing, the transcendent qualities of it. A lot of people have spoken of the sense that it's almost a bodily experience, that, you know, there's something profound. Of course, I know there are lots of people who see it and say, wow, what a yawn.
Right. Especially if you see it today and compare it to other science fiction films like Star Wars or something that you've
I
seen
totally,
since then, right?
I disagree. I don't think there has been anything that has topped it for its ability to convey the limitlessness and the terror of space. I don't find that in any other science fiction film. I think the special effects have really not been bested in the sense of believability. In fact, special effects in this film you're not aware of special effects. You're aware of being on this journey and traveling in the same space that these beings are traveling in, and everything else kind of falls away if you give yourself over to it. And I would say, if you can't relate to the experience, and I would say don't see it on a television or an iPod or an iPad or an iPhone.
No, see it on an iPod Nano.
Right.
Especially small screen. That's the best experience.
If you have to have a capacity for awe and let it wash over you. And then after that, you can start to kind of get into the nitty-gritty of what Kubrick is trying to say about humankind and history. But there are no definitive answers. And that was the other thing I learned from seeing this film, how a work of art could have multitudes of meanings. And I remember there was this kid who was a science geek in my class, and we were at our lockers, and he was like, what do you think the monolith means? And I said, it means so many things. And he said, well, actually, in the Arthur C. Clarke novel, it's the blah, 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 blah. And I said, no, that's, you cannot pin a definition on what this thing is. And that was a real leap for me at that age. And, you know, the movie just opened up so many possibilities. I was a film lover already, but this made me see film in a completely different way, the endlessness of its possibilities.
What I meant in my reference to Star Wars, I was thinking of battles and action.
Right.
And you don't get a lot of that in 2001.
No,
Chris.
You do not.
I just want to say that the monolith clearly is a prescient imagining of the iPhone on which you absolutely must watch 2001. So I, in some ways, represent the post-Star Wars generation in that I was born the year after this film came out. And certainly it is a beautiful film, and I support everything that Linda just said about it. But I do understand Dan's question about what sort of generations since then might think, or barriers to entry, if indeed you have been accustomed to a different kind of special effect. I know when I first saw it, certainly I'm a lot older than my current students today, I had already been exposed to a variety of more, in some ways, less, more advanced, but perhaps less artistically so, special effects. And so it took me a little while after the first viewing of the film to develop, and I was not yet a cinephile when I first saw it, to develop an appreciation for the film's qualities. I think you left off another word that's often used to describe the film, and that is elliptical in its narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because indeed, if you're looking for an action-packed science fiction film, this is not the movie for you, but nor was that its intent. And indeed, it is about the exploration of the metaphysical and sort of, you know, who we are, what is our place in the universe. And I think it is a remarkable film for all of those reasons, and also, like many Kubrick films, for its advancement of cinematic technology. In film after film, Kubrick would take risks, and what he left behind allowed others to build on his legacy. And this certainly is an example of that.
I read in preparation for the show that some people walked out of the theater. They thought it was too long. They couldn't understand it. The word puzzling or baffling is used a lot of times. And so what was the critical reception to the film? Do we know what from the history of it?
Well, there's, you know, a lot of mixed opinions about that, because people's memories are faulty. A lot of those people are gone. But I think there were audiences, especially preview audiences, I think, were kind of baffled and left in the dark. The critical opinion at first was pretty mixed, but it was taken up fairly quickly by young audiences. Some would say because they quickly learned that if they were going to go in to see this movie, to be maybe high would enhance their experience. But, you know, it was the right film for the times, and it was a very obviously chaotic, revolutionary time, and young people were just beginning to understand that cinema was a very important medium, that it had much to say about what was going on in the world, and it became a kind of phenomenon. You know, people flocked to see what it was about, to find out why everybody was either saying, oh, it's, you know, super long and boring, or, oh my God, it was like a trip, you know.
It's the number one film of 1968.
Yeah.
So it was certainly, it was a hit.
And within a couple weeks of its release, it had already outgrossed Dr. Zhivago, which up to that point in the year was the highest grossing film. So it wasn't like, oh, this film sat around for months and months and months and barely made it, and then all of a sudden for some reason. No, it fairly quickly became a cultural phenomenon.
I was going to say Dr. Zhivago, another science fiction hit of nonsense. Kidding. So, you know, the irony is that whereas perhaps young people today might initially have some difficulty appreciating what the film means or meant for its time, it was embraced by the 20-year-olds of that era. As Linda said, very quickly became quite the phenomenon.
One of the key characters in this film is a voice. It's HAL 9000, the computer So the actor who plays Hal, we never see him. We just see the computer. And Hal is remarkable. Hal goes from being sort of a guide on the trip, the omnipresent, maybe voice of gentle voice of God, maybe helping along the crew, the two-man crew, and he becomes homicidal at some point. Well, take us on the journey of Hal, would you, Chris?
Right. So he's voiced by Canadian actor Douglas Rain. Indeed, Hal is a model for all menacing AIs of subsequent stories, because he does start out quite benevolent, mm-hmm. but quickly realizes that perhaps this voyage to Jupiter would go better without those inconvenient humans whose very humanity might jeopardize the mission.
We should say that the mission is to figure out what this monolith is about. Isn't
That's
that
right?
Right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So they sent this ship off into space toward Jupiter.
Toward Jupiter, uh-huh.
Right, because there's this big black monolith that's we don't know what it's doing, but it has some kind of power, right?
That's right. And you mentioned in your intro the music that's used in the film, and we should all bow our heads for a moment of silence for the poor composer Alex North, who wrote 40 minutes of music right. that was never used because
Is
Kubrick
right?
opted instead to use Khachaturian, both Strauss's, Rickard and Johann, and then, of course, the music we hear on the trip to Jupiter, which is Khachaturian's Adagio, which is just so beautiful.
Okay, listen to a little bit of that, and then we'll get to Hal. So Hal does a lot of talking in this film.
You know, he's the on-ship, the onboard computer that guides them when they're in hibernation. This is another sort of early view of humans in hibernated sleep, which is the way you would travel vast distances. Of course, that's now become commonplace in science fiction. And he starts out in, you know, a television interview that is broadcast from Earth that the crew members listen to, declaring how his HAL 9000 computer is incapable of error.
Good afternoon, Hal. How's everything going?
Good afternoon, Mr. Aymer. Everything is going extremely well.
Hal, you have an enormous responsibility on this mission. In many ways, perhaps the greatest responsibility of any single mission element. You're the brain and central nervous system of the ship, and your responsibilities include watching over the men in hibernation. Does this ever cause you any lack of confidence?
Let me put it this way, Mr. Aymer. The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
Yes, and I think you can read the human tones in this voice. And of course, the interesting thing is that Hal is far more human than any human in the scenario. All of the astronauts in the film are devoid of personality, really. And I think we'll hear that more in the next clip with Dave Bowman, one of the key astronauts, the two key astronauts. And this, of course, is Kubrick's ironic comment on the state of contemporary civilization, that for all of its advancements, and we've seen at the beginning the apes, the primitive apes, who through the intervention of the monolith have learned to use the bone as a weapon, and then we get that famous match cut to the spaceship.
Just mention that for a moment. This famous match cut is the bone is tossed into the air.
Yes. As it descends, right as it begins to descend from the air, we cut to a match on form, the form of the spaceship that is almost exactly the same shape as the bone.
Yeah, right.
Suggesting in one quick cut both that this is how millennia have been transcended, but essentially what we have here is a bone, a weapon, a spaceship that really, for all intents and purposes, is also a weapon, and that humankind has really not progressed all that much. Everybody's very civilized and quiet and polite and proper to the point of being completely devoid of any human aspects, but the aggression and the warlike nature is still there. We're fighting the Russians in this very civilized way with all these high-tech machines that have only carried us to the brink of destruction. And so Hal
is part of that machine.
Yes. And yet we latch on to him as the one character in the film who we have any kind of emotional response to. And some people have said, you know, everybody else in the movie is so boring. Well, that's precisely the point. This is Kubrick's commentary on the current state of affairs. And so as he gets more and more human, it becomes more and more interesting. And it's the one point in the film that we can see a kind of more traditional narrative development.
Indeed, that's completely by design. And I just want to say one other thing about that wonderful match cut, which is, as I always like to say, film is the art of time or manipulation of time. And this is a wonderful example of that because we leap forward millions of years in a single cut. And I love that aspect because it really demonstrates what you can do through editing.
Yeah, it's absolutely breathtaking.
Hal becomes very protective or defensive of the mission, right?
And indeed, but before he gets quite to that point, we start to sense that perhaps he has a little bit more of a personality and perhaps more neuroses than we were originally led to believe.
Is a good word.
As we hear in this next moment, he starts to talk about potentially having second thoughts. I mean, how can an AI have second thoughts? And I love how Kubrick cuts to these constant shots of that red eye that is, you know, Hal's way of viewing, his POV or our POV of his eye. And it begins to develop a menace as we hear him become more and more fraught in his musings.
Good evening, Dave.
How you doing, Hal?
Everything's running smoothly, and you?
Oh, not too bad.
Have you been doing some more work?
A few sketches.
May I see them?
Sure.
That's a very nice rendering, Dave. I think you've improved a great deal. Can you hold it a bit closer?
Sure.
That's Dr. Hunter, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, not at all.
Well, forgive me for being so inquisitive. But during the past few weeks, I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission.
How do you mean?
Well, it's rather difficult to define. Perhaps I'm just projecting my own concern about it. I know I've never completely freed myself of the suspicion that there are some extremely odd things about this mission. I'm sure you'll agree there's some truth in what I say.
One of my vivid memories of watching the film way back, I think it was in college the first time, was Hal. Hal was not benevolent, not benign to me. I knew there was going to be trouble with Hal. There's this tension that builds, and certainly that's where he takes us, right? As Dave, played by Keir Dulay, finds out, and Dave's co-pilot, Dr. Frank Poole.
Right, who's played by Gary Lockwood, who Star Trek fans would know as in one of those early Star Trek episodes, the guy who develops divine powers in an early episode and his eyes start to glow brightly. I'm a big Star Trek fan. I don't quite remember the name of that episode, but he was the lead villain.
So Hal.
So since the last clip, Hal has decided, after sensing that both Dave and Frank are planning to perhaps shut him off because they have begun to sense the same thing that we, the audience, are sensing, which is that all is not right with Hal, and they lock themselves in a pod meant to explore outside, but Hal can read their lips. So then when Frank goes outside the ship, Hal maneuvers one of the pods to cut his lifeline, and Frank goes spinning off into space, and then Dave, who goes out to rescue Frank, is trying to get back into the ship, and Hal won't let him back in.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal? Do you read me, Hal? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
This film was directed by Stanley Kubrick, who only a few years earlier had directed Dr. Strangelove, using satire to make commentary about the dangers of advances in technology and humans meeting technology and maybe blowing up the world, right? Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't forget that. I mean, it's a very different film, Dr. Strangelove. It's funny. Mm-hmm. I don't know that 2001 is ever really funny. But anyway, this is Stanley Kubrick issuing another warning, right?
Oh, yes. All of his work concerns this question of what it means to be human and what our relationship is to the inhuman technology that we've created, that we've surrounded ourselves with. And also this notion of progress, I think, was really important to him. I would say that in some ways, 2001 is his most optimistic movie, even though he paints a very kind of terrifying picture of the present of 2001, where everybody is isolated in their own world. No, there is no real human feeling or contact, but there is, at the end, this idea of the possibility of monumental transcendence into something unknown, but possibly very hopeful. And then, of course, that all kind of goes away in his next film, which is Clockwork Orange. It's interesting because a number of his films, particularly during that period, kind of talk to each other. And we've seen the end of the world in Strange Love, where the world is blown up by, you know, the bomb that finally gets dropped. And then the beginning of 2001 is the beginning of the world.
It's the dawn of man.
Yes. And I've heard people say that, you know, at the end of this film, we have the Star Child. And at the beginning of Clockwork Orange, we have Alex DeLarge looking kind of like the Star Child with his big blue eye and exaggerated. But that's a very sinister reading of what the Star Child is all about at the end of this film.
I don't know if this is as optimistic as The Shining, though, which is...
oh, yes, that's a real upper.
I agree with you that there is a lot of hope for humanity in this film that we don't necessarily see in subsequent movies of his.
Hal is admitting to some mistakes, right? Some bad decision-making. What's going on with Hal now?
Well, Dave gets the better of him. He sort of works his way back into the ship by forcing open an airlock and is now determined that Hal needs to be shut down.
Oh, so Hal is playing a little bit nice so he doesn't get shut down.
Indeed, because Hal wants to live. And this is, in fact, where Kubrick, going off of what Linda was saying, really plays on our sympathies. Because although we, being human, don't want Hal to kill Dave, it's really quite moving when we hear Hal plead for Dave to stop shutting him down. And we hear his voice slow down as Dave is pulling out the panels, the circuitry that gives Hal his intelligence.
I know I've made some very poor decisions recently, but I can give you my complete assurance that my work will be back to normal. I've still got the greatest enthusiasm and confidence in the mission, and I want to help you. Dave, stop. Stop, will you? Stop, Dave. Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid, Dave.
This one, it really actually makes me cry, kind of. It's so sad.
It is very sad, which is remarkable because, yes, he's just so good at manipulating your sympathies.
Hal is really, he's in distress, right? He's being shut down. I was scared of Hal watching this film. But you can see where audience would feel an emotional connection to him.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting about what Kubrick is doing here, because at first, of course, as bland and unremarkable as Frank and Dave are, mm-hmm. we still they're our protagonists and we're with them. So we don't want Hal to kill them or best them. And it's really horrifying when Frank goes spinning off into space. But we've heard Dave in that previous clip just really being annoyed with Hal. You know, he treats this computer with a bit of contempt. And there's a kind of hubris in that, no matter what. You know, I know that you're supposedly the superior intelligence, but I'm human, so, you know, that's just, forget about it. And then as soon as Hal starts to plot their demise, we're on their side. And then when Dave starts to dismantle him, we start to feel really sorry for Hal. And in fact, his final moments are heartbreaking. Oddly heartbreaking.
Because he's regressing back to childhood.
Yes.
To the first thing he learned. Right?
We get that regression, and it says so many things about, again, what does it mean to be human, and how can we think and talk about machines regressing in this very human, sympathetic way.
It's even more than human, just this idea of sentience, right? And sort of, you know, beyond the human, because after all, this is a movie that explores life beyond our world. Mm-hmm. And what would we do if we encountered life beyond our world, right? Would we see it as a threat? Would it see us as a threat? So I like how this film tackles these issues even beyond the human. But yes, we cry for Hal, whatever our earlier feelings were about him. And so Dave succeeds in resetting him, and then continues to remove the circuitry, and that's when Hal is indeed back to basics, and his voice is slowed down even more, and then he sings this melancholy version of Daisy.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I am a Hal 9000 computer. I became operational at the HAL plant in Urbana, Illinois, on the 12th of January, 1992. My instructor was Mr. Langley, and he taught me to sing a song. If you'd like to hear it, I can sing it for you.
Yes, I'd like to hear it, Hal. Sing it for me.
It's called Daisy. 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 Give me your answer, too.
I read where Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, who was the author of the story that became the film, consulted with Carl Sagan about what an alien should look like, an alien form. And Sagan's advice was to avoid trying to humanize aliens, to give them our forms, you know, heads and legs and arms, which is the standard look of aliens in most movies that we see.
Unfortunately,
right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
That's part of the reason why they ended up with the monolith. It's not space aliens, arms and legs and long fingers strangling people and starship battles, right?
It's an indecipherable blank. It's this monumental nothing. You know, it's a piece of slate upon which you project whatever interpretation you wish, which is exactly what people do when they talk about the monolith. What does it mean?
Right.
What
and it shows mean? Up at the end of the film again, mm-hmm. where Dave is an old man, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's laying on a bed, presumably dying. He's breathing heavily, and the monolith appears at the foot of his bed. Mm-hmm. And then we have this amazing transition to what I refer to as the fetus. You refer to it as the
star child.
The star child.
Which is what it is called in the screenplay.
Oh, it is. Okay.
And yes, I heard, or maybe it was reading that piece in Vanity Fair by Bruce Handy, which is really great. It's a nice piece about the making of the film.
It's a current Vanity Fair?
Yeah. Is it the current or the one before this?
It's this year. It's not that long.
It's recent.
Okay.
And apparently Kubrick, of course, obsessed with every single detail and researching everything he could get his hands on, wanted some scientific lab to send him various stages of human fetuses so that he could get it right. And the lab wrote back and said, sorry, no can do. No human fetuses. But yes, it's the beginning. It's the new beginning. But what that new beginning will be, no one knows.
Right.
I really do appreciate the fact that we don't get bipedal aliens. It's one of the things I also liked about Denis Villeneuve's Arrival of a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
However, just one note of regret about the design of the film. I wish for all the brilliant work done in the special effects and in the avoidance of such aliens, I only wish that they had shown the same intelligence in the costume design in the earlier scenes of our humans in ostensible future, because the problem sometimes with watching science fiction of the 1960s is that everyone is still dressed in the 1960s. I mean, Star Trek had this same problem. Women in miniskirts, men with the same haircuts. It just basically, it's the look of its time meant to be the future. That is the one area in which I feel like the design of the movie could be better, because otherwise I think it's a work of cinematic brilliance, as we've discussed. It's not alone. I think quite a lot of science fiction films suffer from this in their imagining of the near future. We've had so many science fiction films since then. Some do it better than others.
From time to time, 2001 A Space Odyssey is shown at the Charles or the Senator Theater. That's where you ought to see it, maybe on a college campus on a large screen, although screens are getting bigger at home, so you can probably get away with it. But if you haven't seen it, we certainly recommend it.
Yes, very, very big screen.
Yeah.
With surround sound, whatever.
Yeah. Ignore what I said about the iPod Nano.
Yeah, there was a 70mm roadshow of the film not that long ago, and I wish they would bring that back for
that'd be exciting.
This anniversary.
Thank you for mentioning the Vanity Fair piece, too. We'll provide a link to that in the notes of this podcast. Linda, Chris, thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks, Dan. It's been great as always.
A pleasure.
Linda DeLibro is Director of Film and Media Studies at the Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed is Professor and Chair in the Department of Film and Moving Image at Stevenson University. They join us once a month to talk about current and classic cinema. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get a chance. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking from the Baltimore Sun, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966. Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 374 for Wednesday, April 11th, 2018. That familiar music was composed in 1896 in Germany by Richard Strauss. The director, Stanley Kubrick, picked it up for his film 2001: A Space Odyssey, and the piece has been forever associated with that. Although Elvis used it to open his concerts in the 1970s in Vegas, and Deodata got all funky with it in 1973. But it's most associated with 2001, and that's what we're here to talk about today, because this month marks the 50th anniversary of Kubrick's science fiction epic, the biggest box office hit of 1968, a film variously described as hypnotic, opaque, a milestone of cinema. It remains one of the most popular films in public opinion surveys, and it's also known for being remarkably puzzling for a lot of people. popular yet puzzling, with an ape throwing a bone, a black monolith, and the final image at the end of the 2.5-hour film, a fetus. Say what? Here to talk about 2001: A Space Odyssey are our film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. Linda, Chris, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Dan.
Excellent to be here.
Excellent, because this is an excellent film. I love to talk about this, and I want to see the film again. The anniversary makes me want to see it again. I haven't seen it in several years, but I thought it was remarkable. Did you like the film the first time you saw it, Linda?
It changed my life, and I'm really I'm not overplaying that. I've thought about it a lot through the years. It was the film that made me realize that cinema was the most important art form. And, you know, I was quite young when I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't even mention this except that it's an experience that is echoed in so many accounts of first experiences of seeing the film, particularly for people who are under the age of like 15 or even 10. This sense of wonder, the magnificence of it, the sensation of being in a world that is all engulfing, the transcendent qualities of it. A lot of people have spoken of the sense that it's almost a bodily experience, that, you know, there's something profound. Of course, I know there are lots of people who see it and say, wow, what a yawn.
Right. Especially if you see it today and compare it to other science fiction films like Star Wars or something that you've seen
totally,
since then, right?
I disagree. I don't think there has been anything that has topped it for its ability to convey the limitlessness and the terror of space. I don't find that in any other science fiction film. I think the special effects have really not been bested in the sense of believability. In fact, special effects in this film you're not aware of special effects. You're aware of being on this journey and traveling in the same space that these beings are traveling in, and everything else kind of falls away if you give yourself over to it. And I would say, if you can't relate to the experience, and I would say don't see it on a television or an iPod or an iPad or an iPhone.
No, see it on an iPod Nano.
Right.
Especially small screen. That's the best experience.
If you have to have a capacity for awe and let it wash over you. And then after that, you can start to kind of get into the nitty-gritty of what Kubrick is trying to say about humankind and history. But there are no definitive answers. And that was the other thing I learned from seeing this film, how a work of art could have multitudes of meanings. And I remember there was this kid who was a science geek in my class, and we were at our lockers, and he was like, what do you think the monolith means? And I said, it means so many things. And he said, well, actually, in the Arthur C. Clarke novel, it's the blah, 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 blah. And I said, no, you cannot pin a definition on what this thing is. And that was a real leap for me at that age. And, you know, the movie just opened up so many possibilities. I was a film lover already, but this made me see film in a completely different way, the endlessness of its possibilities.
What I meant in my reference to Star Wars, I was thinking of battles and action.
Right.
And you don't get a lot of that in 2001.
No,
Chris.
You
do not.
I just want to say that the monolith clearly is a prescient imagining of the iPhone on which you absolutely must watch 2001 movie. So I, in some ways, represent the post-Star Wars generation in that I was born the year after this film came out. And certainly it is a beautiful film, and I support everything that Linda just said about it. But I do understand Dan's question about what sort of generations since then might think, or barriers to entry, if indeed you have been accustomed to a different kind of special effect. I know when I first saw it, certainly I'm a lot older than my current students today, I had already been exposed to a variety of more in some ways, less, more advanced, but perhaps less artistically so, special effects. And so it took me a little while after the first viewing of the film to develop, and I was not yet a cinephile when I first saw it, to develop an appreciation for the film's qualities. I think you left off another word that's often used to describe the film, and that is elliptical in its narrative, right? Mm-hmm. Because indeed, if you're looking for an action-packed science fiction film, this is not the movie for you, but nor was that its intent. And indeed, it is about the exploration of the metaphysical and sort of, you know, who we are, what is our place in the universe. And I think it is a remarkable film for all of those reasons, and also, like many Kubrick films, for its advancement of cinematic technology. In film after film, Kubrick would take risks, and what he left behind allowed others to build on his legacy. And this certainly is an example of that.
I read in preparation for the show that some people walked out of the theater. They thought it was too long. They couldn't understand it. The word puzzling or baffling is used a lot of times. And so what was the critical reception to the film? Do we know what from the history of it?
Well, there's, you know, a lot of mixed opinions about that, because people's memories are faulty. A lot of those people are gone. But I think there were audiences, especially preview audiences, I think, were kind of baffled and left in the dark. The critical opinion at first was pretty mixed, but it was taken up fairly quickly by young audiences. Some would say because they quickly learned that if they were going to go in to see this movie, to be maybe high would enhance their experience. But, you know, it was the right film for the times, and it was a very obviously chaotic, revolutionary time, and young people were just beginning to understand that cinema was a very important medium, that it had much to say about what was going on in the world, and it became a kind of phenomenon. You know, people flocked to see what it was about, to find out why everybody was either saying, oh, it's, you know, super long and boring, or, oh my God, it was like a trip, you know.
It's the number one film of 1968.
Yeah.
So it was certainly, it was a hit.
And within a couple weeks of its release, it had already outgrossed Dr. Zhivago, which up to that point in the year was the highest grossing film. So it wasn't like, oh, this film sat around for months and months and months and barely made it, and then all of a sudden for some reason. No, it fairly quickly became a cultural phenomenon.
I was going to say Dr. Zhivago, another science fiction hit of nonsense. Kidding. So, you know, the irony is that whereas perhaps young people today might initially have some difficulty appreciating what the film means or meant for its time, it was embraced by the 20-year-olds of that era. As Linda said, very quickly became quite the phenomenon.
One of the key characters in this film is a voice. It's HAL 9000, the computer. So the actor who plays HAL, we never see him. We just see the computer. And HAL is remarkable. HAL goes from being sort of a guide on the trip, the omnipresent, maybe gentle voice of God, maybe helping along the crew, the two-man crew, and he becomes homicidal at some point. Well, take us on the journey of HAL, would you, Chris?
Right, so he's voiced by Canadian actor Douglas Rain. Indeed, HAL is a model for all menacing AIs of subsequent stories, because he does start out quite benevolent, mm-hmm. but quickly realizes that perhaps this voyage to Jupiter would go better without those inconvenient humans whose very humanity might jeopardize the mission.
We should say that the mission is to figure out what this monolith is about. Isn't
that
right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So they've sent this ship off into space toward Jupiter.
Toward Jupiter. Huh?
Right, because there's this big black monolith that's, we don't know what it's doing, but it has some kind of power, right?
That's right. And you mentioned in your intro the music that's used in the film, and we should all bow our heads for a moment of silence for the poor composer Alex North, who wrote 40 minutes of music that was never used, because Kubrick opted instead to use Khachaturian, both Strauss's, Rickard and Johann, and then, of course, the music we hear on the trip to Jupiter, which is Khachaturian's Adagio, which is just so beautiful.
Okay, listen to a little bit of that, and then we'll get to HAL. It's So Hal does a lot of talking in this film.
You know, he's the on-ship, the onboard computer that guides them when they're in hibernation. This is another sort of early view of humans in hibernated sleep, which is the way you would travel vast distances. Of course, that's now become commonplace in science fiction. And he starts out in, you know, a television interview that is broadcast from Earth that the crew members listen to, declaring how his HAL 9000 computer is incapable of error.
Good afternoon, Hal. How's everything going?
Good afternoon, Mr. Aymer. Everything is going extremely well.
Hal, you have an enormous responsibility on this mission. In many ways, perhaps the greatest responsibility of any single mission element. You're the brain and central nervous system of the ship, and your responsibilities include watching over the men in hibernation. Does this ever cause you any lack of confidence?
Let me put it this way, Mr. Aymer. The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
Yes, and I think you can read the human tones in this voice. And of course, the interesting thing is that Hal is far more human than any human in the scenario. All of the astronauts in the film are devoid of personality, really. And I think we'll hear that more in the next clip with Dave Bowman, one of the key astronauts, the two key astronauts. And this, of course, is Kubrick's ironic comment on the state of contemporary civilization, that for all of its advancements, and we've seen at the beginning the apes, the primitive apes, who through the intervention of the monolith have learned to use the bone as a weapon, and then we get that famous match cut to the spaceship.
Just mention that for a moment. This famous match cut is the bone is tossed into the air.
Yes. As it descends, right as it begins to descend from the air, we cut to a match on form, the form of the spaceship that is almost exactly the same shape as the bone.
Yeah, right.
Suggesting in one quick cut both that this is how millennia have been transcended, but essentially what we have here is a bone, a weapon, a spaceship that really, for all intents and purposes, is also a weapon, and that humankind has really not progressed all that much. Everybody's very civilized and quiet and polite and proper to the point of being completely devoid of any human aspects, but the aggression and the warlike nature is still there. We're fighting the Russians in this very civilized way with all these high-tech machines that have only carried us to the brink of destruction. And so Hal
is part of that machine.
Yes, and yet we latch on to him as the one character in the film who we have any kind of emotional response to. And some people have said, you know, everybody else in the movie is so boring. Well, that's precisely the point. This is Kubrick's commentary on the current state of affairs. And so as he gets more and more human, it becomes more and more interesting. And it's the one point in the film that we can see a kind of more traditional narrative development.
Indeed, that's completely by design. And I just want to say one other thing about that wonderful match cut, which is, as I always like to say, film is the art of time or manipulation of time. And this is a wonderful example of that because we leap forward millions of years in a single cut. And I love that aspect because it really demonstrates what you can do through editing.
Yeah, it's absolutely breathtaking.
Hal becomes very protective or defensive of the mission, right?
And indeed, but before he gets quite to that point, we start to sense that perhaps he has a little bit more of a personality and perhaps more neuroses than we were originally led to believe.
Is a good word.
As we hear in this next moment, he starts to talk about potentially having second thoughts. I mean, how can an AI have second thoughts? And I love how Kubrick cuts to these constant shots of that red eye that is, you know, Hal's way of viewing, his POV or our POV of his eye. And it begins to develop a menace as we hear him become more and more fraught in his musings.
Good evening, Dave.
How you doing, Hal?
Everything's running smoothly, and you?
Oh, not too bad.
Have you been doing some more work?
A few sketches.
May I see them?
Sure.
That's a very nice rendering, Dave. I think you've improved a great deal. Can you hold it a bit closer?
Sure.
That's Dr. Hunter, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, not at all.
Well, forgive me for being so inquisitive. But during the past few weeks, I've wondered whether you might be having some second thoughts about the mission.
How do you mean?
Well, it's rather difficult to define. Perhaps I'm just projecting my own concern about it. I know I've never completely freed myself of the suspicion that there are some extremely odd things about this mission. I'm sure you'll agree there's some truth in what I say.
One of my vivid memories of watching the film way back, I think it was in college the first time, was Hal. Hal was not benevolent, not benign to me. I knew there was going to be trouble with Hal. There's this tension that builds, and certainly that's where he takes us, right? As Dave, played by Keir Dulay, finds out, and Dave's co-pilot, Dr. Frank Poole.
Right, who's played by Gary Lockwood, who Star Trek fans would know as in one of those early Star Trek episodes, the guy who develops divine powers in an early episode and his eyes start to glow brightly. I'm a big Star Trek fan. I don't quite remember the name of that episode, but but he was the lead villain.
So Hal.
So since the last clip, Hal has decided, after sensing that both Dave and Frank are planning to perhaps shut him off because they have begun to sense the same thing that we, the audience, are sensing, which is that all is not right with Hal, and they lock themselves in a pod meant to explore outside, but Hal can read their lips. So then when Frank goes outside the ship, Hal maneuvers one of the pods to cut his lifeline, and Frank goes spinning off into space, and then Dave, who goes out to rescue Frank, is trying to get back into the ship, and Hal won't let him back in.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal? Do you read me, Hal? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
This film was directed by Stanley Kubrick, who only a few years earlier had directed Dr. Strangelove, using satire to make commentary about the dangers of advances in technology and humans meeting technology and maybe blowing up the world, right? Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't forget that. I mean, it's a very different film, Dr. Strangelove. It's funny. Mm-hmm. I don't know that 2001 is ever really funny. But anyway, this is Stanley Kubrick issuing another warning, right?
Oh, yes. All of his work concerns this question of what it means to be human and what our relationship is to the inhuman technology that we've created, that we've surrounded ourselves with. And also this notion of progress, I think, was really important to him. I would say that in some ways, 2001 is his most optimistic movie, even though he paints a very kind of terrifying picture of the present of 2001, where everybody is isolated in their own world. No, there is no real human feeling or contact, but there is, at the end, this idea of the possibility of monumental transcendence into something unknown but possibly very hopeful. And then, of course, that all kind of goes away in his next film, which is Clockwork Orange. It's interesting because a number of his films, particularly during that period, kind of talk to each other. And we've seen the end of the world in Strange Love, where the world is blown up by, you know, the bomb that finally gets dropped. And then the beginning of 2001 is the beginning of the world.
It's the dawn of man.
Yes. And some, I've heard people say that, you know, at the end of this film, we have the Star Child. And at the beginning of Clockwork Orange, we have Alex DeLarge looking kind of like the Star Child with his big blue eye. And
oh,
with
really?
Exaggerated. But that's a very sinister reading of what the Star Child is all about at the end of this film.
I don't know if this is as optimistic as The Shining, though, which is...
oh, yes, that's a real upper.
I agree with you that there is a lot of hope for humanity in this film that we don't necessarily see in subsequent movies of his.
Hal is admitting to some mistakes, right? Some bad decision-making. What's going on with Hal now?
Well, Dave gets the better of him. He sort of works his way back into the ship by forcing open an airlock and is now determined that Hal needs to be shut down.
Oh, so Hal is playing a little bit nice so he doesn't get shut down.
Indeed, because Hal wants to live. And this is, in fact, where Kubrick, going off of what Linda was saying, really plays on our sympathies. Because although we, being human, don't want Hal to kill Dave, it's really quite moving when we hear Hal plead for Dave to stop shutting him down. And we hear his voice slow down as Dave is pulling out the panels, the circuitry that gives Hal his intelligence.
I know I've made some very poor decisions recently, but I can give you my complete assurance that my work will be back to normal. I've still got the greatest enthusiasm and confidence in the mission, and I want to help you. Dave, stop. Stop, will you? Stop, Dave. Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid, Dave.
This one, it really actually makes me cry, kind of. It's
so
sad. It
is very sad, which is remarkable because, yes, he's just so good at manipulating your sympathies.
Hal is really, he's in distress, right? He's being shut down. I was scared of Hal watching this film. But you can see where audience would feel an emotional connection to him.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting about what Kubrick is doing here, because at first, of course, as bland and unremarkable as Frank and Dave are, mm-hmm. we still, they're our protagonists and we're with them. So we don't want Hal to kill them or best them. And it's really horrifying when Frank goes spinning off into space. But we've heard Dave in that previous clip just really being annoyed with Hal. You know, he treats this computer with a bit of contempt, and there's a kind of hubris in that. No matter what, you know, I know that you're supposedly the superior intelligence, but I'm human, so, you know, that's just forget about it. And then as soon as Hal starts to plot their demise, we're on their side. And then when Dave starts to dismantle him, we start to feel really sorry for Hal. And in fact, his final moments are heartbreaking, oddly heartbreaking.
Because he's regressing back to childhood.
Yes.
To the first thing he learned. Right?
We get that regression, and it says so many things about, again, what does it mean to be human, and how can we think and talk about machines regressing in this very human, sympathetic way?
It's even more than human, just this idea of sentience, right? And sort of, you know, beyond the human, because after all, this is a movie that explores life beyond our world. Mm-hmm. And what would we do if we encountered life beyond our world, right? Would we see it as a threat? Would it see us as a threat? So I like how this film tackles these issues even beyond the human. But yes, we cry for Hal, whatever our earlier feelings were about him. And so Dave succeeds in resetting him, and then continues to remove the circuitry, and that's when Hal is indeed back to basics, and his voice is slowed down even more, and then he sings this melancholy version of Daisy.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I am a HAL 9000 computer. I became operational at the HAL plant in Urbana, Illinois, on the 12th of January, 1992. My instructor was Mr. Langley, and he taught me to sing a song. If you'd like to hear it, I can sing it for you.
Yes, I'd like to hear it, Hal. Sing it for me.
It's called Daisy. 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 Give me your answer, too.
I read where Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, who was the author of the story that became the film, consulted with Carl Sagan about what an alien should look like, an alien form. And Sagan's advice was to avoid trying to humanize aliens, to give them our forms, you know, heads and legs and arms, which is the standard look of aliens in most movies that we see.
Unfortunately, right? Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
That's part of the reason why they ended up with the monolith. It's not space aliens, arms and legs and long fingers strangling people and starship battles, right?
It's an indecipherable blank. It's this monumental nothing. You know, it's a piece of slate upon which you project whatever interpretation you wish, which is exactly what people do when they talk about the monolith. What does it mean?
Right.
What
and it shows mean? Up at the end of the film again, mm-hmm. where Dave is an old man, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's laying on a bed, presumably dying. He's breathing heavily, and the monolith appears at the foot of his bed.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have this amazing transition to what I refer to as the fetus. You refer to it as the
star child.
The star child.
Which is what it is called in the screenplay.
Oh, it is. Okay.
And yes, I heard, or maybe it was reading that piece in Vanity Fair by Bruce Handy, which is really great. It's a nice piece about the making of the film.
It's a current Vanity Fair?
Yeah. Is it the current or the one before this?
It's this year. It's not that
it's
long
recent.
Ago.
Okay.
And apparently Kubrick, of course, obsessed with every single detail and researching everything he could get his hands on, wanted some scientific lab to send him various stages of human fetuses so that he could get it right. And the lab wrote back and said, sorry, no can do. No human fetuses. But yes, it's the beginning. It's the new beginning. But what that new beginning will be, no one knows.
Right.
I really do appreciate the fact that we don't get bipedal aliens. It's one of the things I also liked about Denis Villeneuve's Arrival of a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
However, just one note of regret about the design of the film. I wish for all the brilliant work done in the special effects and in the avoidance of such aliens, I only wish that they had shown the same intelligence in the costume design in the earlier scenes of our humans in ostensible future, because the problem sometimes with watching science fiction of the 1960s is that everyone is still dressed in the 1960s. I mean, Star Trek had this same problem. Women in miniskirts, men with the same haircuts. It just basically, it's the look of its time meant to be the future. That is the one area in which I feel like the design of the movie could be better, because otherwise I think it's a work of cinematic brilliance, as we've discussed. It's not alone. I think quite a lot of science fiction films suffer from this in their imagining of the near future. We've had so many science fiction films since then. Some do it better than others.
From time to time, 2001 A Space Odyssey is shown at the Charles or the Senator Theater. That's where you ought to see it, maybe on a college campus on a large screen, although screens are getting bigger at home, so you can probably get away with it. But if you haven't seen it, we certainly recommend it.
Yes, very, very big screen.
Yeah.
With surround sound, whatever.
Yeah.
Ignore what I said about the iPod Nano.
Yeah, there was a 70-millimeter roadshow of the film not that long ago. and I wish they would bring that back for
That'd be exciting.
This anniversary.
Thank you for mentioning the Vanity Fair piece, too. We'll provide a link to that in the notes of this podcast. Linda, Chris, thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks, Dan. It's been great as always.
A pleasure.
Linda DeLibro is Director of Film and Media Studies at the Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed is Professor and Chair in the Department of Film and Moving Image at Stevenson University. They join us once a month to talk about current and classic cinema. That's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get a chance. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking from the Baltimore Sun, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.